Dr. Brooks Agnew spent most of his youth hanging around Caltech and the folks who co-opted at Jet Propulsion Labs. He entered the Air Force in 1973, where he became an electronics engineer. After earning an honorable discharge, he attended Brigham Young, Western Kentucky, Tennessee Technological Universities. He has a bachelor's degree in chemistry, a master's degree in statistics, a Ph.D. in physics. He has published more than 100 articles and papers on subjects ranging from radiation to transdimensional movement through space-time. He was a featured scientist in the 1997 Wendy Robbins documentary on HARP, Holes in Heaven. He also teaches mathematics at Gaston College in North Carolina. Dr. Agnew has recently co-authored a landmark publication on the creation of the Earth, the arc of millions of years. The theoretical physics he presents in the book may ignite the torches of the Nobels as a breakthrough in wormhole mechanics. He's our guest on Coast to Coast. Hello, Dr. Brooks Agnew. How are you?
I'm doing just fine. How are you?
Good. Good to talk with you. Any relation to the late vice president?
No, I don't think so. I think his name was a change from something Italian or Greek.
Yeah, it is a different name, indeed. Hey, tell me, how did you tie in your very heavy science background with some of the things that I read in your book, which I think are just fantastic, which really bounders on creation?
Well, actually, as you go through life trying to discover things, especially mathematics and physics, everybody reaches an impasse. Either you reach the end of all known knowledge, which these days is becoming more and more difficult, if not impossible, to do with our age of information access, or you reach the limit of your ability to learn. And somewhere in that impasse, you sort of stretch your heart out or your soul out to reach for an answer. And if your passion to know that answer still exists, your soul sort of opens up and pure knowledge is poured into it. And as I read the histories of great mathematicians or great physicists, this is, in fact, the way that that they break through from one realm of the known into the unknown and making it known for us. So that's exactly what happened to me. As I grew up in life, I had a religious background, and I reached a point in that where I thought, gee, this is nonsense. I'm going to learn mathematics and physics, and I poured myself into that. And then about 20, 25 years later, I reached an impasse with that, and I said, gee, you know, something's missing here.
Maybe a mix, right?
Yeah. So I was actually giving a lecture one day on the speed of light, and when I finished the lecture, my co-author approached me and said, gee, I've got a great idea for a book, but it needs a physics point of view to round it out. And so we collaborated, and it was like a tremendous light went off, and all the pieces fit together, and we began writing, and 2 years later it was done.
The title of your book is called The Arc of Millions of Years. What does that mean?
Well, in ancient history, back in records known as the Zohar, they talked about Noah's Ark being a great ship that sailed across the cosmic sea. And the Egyptians sort of described this cosmic sea as the rift in the Milky Way. You know, if you look up at the Milky Way, in the middle of it, there's sort of a dark, uninhabited area where there's very few stars. They call that the cosmic sea. And as the record states, when Noah arrived, he said, yes, I sailed across the cosmic sea. And so you have this name that stuck in history called the Ark of Millions of Years, or the Ship of Millions of Years. And so we sort of borrowed that name and used it as the title of the book, and we coupled it with the grand sextile astrological alignment that occurred in November of 2003, which is on the cover of the book, the six planets in the shape of the Star of David with Earth in the center. And I might add, during this particular one, there was a lunar eclipse, which had not occurred since the heralding of the birth of Solomon. So all the symbolism fell together as sort of a timely flag that this knowledge has now been restored, and so we put it in the book.
That was a pretty dramatic celestial event, wasn't it, 2003?
Well, it was and it wasn't. You know, it wasn't on Fox News or the mainstream media, but if you went on the internet and put it in, there are literally just thousands of websites claiming and describing all kinds of significance, that events on the earth are going to change, or that signs have been given that a turn has been taken for mankind and for the existence of the earth.
Let's go back a little bit, if we can, Brooks. There are some people who believe that Earth is 6,000 years old. That's it, 6,000 years old. And, of course, most mainstream scientists that I know believe the planet to be 4.5 billion years old. Where do you stand in this?
Well, that's the, I guess, the core of the book. We believe that the Earth is both 7,000 years old and 4.5 billion years old.
How can it be both?
Well, because there are two Earths. One Earth is a temporal Earth that took 4.5 billion years to develop in this universe. And the other is, let's call it a spiritual Earth, or a spiritually created Earth, much like the one that's described in the second creation in Genesis. And those two Earths were brought together to make this sort of living, vibrating planet upon which we live. And that event was the arrival of Noah.
Well, now that may explain the differences between the two camps.
Well, at one point, it was a gulf. I mean, insurmountable, an impassable gulf. But when we began doing the research for this book, as to the answer, you know, what about this Noah's Ark, we started to see, as we went back through one millennia after another, through ancient records, ancient observers were scientists of their day, I guess, they all made the same observation, and their symbols are all over the place. We, in the book, call it the union of the polarity. It's the construction of the Star of David. It's the construction of the Andean cross, all kinds of spirals and life forces and two-headed things and the yin and the yang. All of this pointed toward a union of a spirit earth and a temporal earth into one earth on which we live today.
That's fascinating. Okay, let's pick it up from Noah. Tell me what you believe this episode was, and of course the Bible has its definition, and then some other people have their own.
Right. Well, I guess you could begin in Genesis, in the first creation series. If you just read it for what it is, without interpretation, without lectern thumping or yelling or screaming or damnation, what you see is basically a water planet upon which God moved his spirit and divided the water planet into two water planets and then put a heaven in between them, and then separated the dry land from the water, and then on the third day gave it a sun and a moon to govern its time. Well, somewhere in the two first periods of development, this did not turn into a frozen ball. It moved from where it was created to where it now exists. And what I tried to do as a physicist, cosmologically speaking, trying to figure out some mechanism by which you could move a planet from where it was created, let's say in the center of our galaxy, to where it now rests in orbit around this main sequence sun, without freezing it. In other words, it's got to move in a fairly good amount of time without turning into a frozen ball, and it's got to carry Noah and all of his ancestors intact to this planet. So the answer was in spinning black holes. Now, there's been a lot of research done on this, although not directly, mathematically speaking, or through what we call perturbation theories.
You think then the entire planet, Earth, somehow went through a black hole to arrive at its present location?
Yes.
That's a fascinating thing. Now, this is a first, Brooks.
Well, see, when a black hole spins, and they all do, because they're just the, I guess, the end life cycle of a collapsing star. If you look through a solar telescope at our sun, for instance, you'll see it rotating. you'll see a sunspot traveling across the face of the sun to give you evidence that our sun is rotating on its axis. But at the end of our sun's life, when its fuel is exhausted, it will begin to cool and to shrink. And as it shrinks, by conservation of momentum, it will spin faster and faster and faster. And if our sun was large enough, say about 50 times its current mass, it would not only collapse past the supernova stage to a white dwarf, but it would continue to collapse to become a black hole. And that spinning would continue to increase. Now, if